Welcome and thank you so much for joining the Psychology Is podcast. I'm here today with Dr. Anna Lemke. And Dr. Lemke is a professor and medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University, among other titles that you hold. Also the author of two books, Dopamine Nation is your newest book, subtitle of which is Finding Balance in an Age of Indulgence. And then your other book from, I believe, 2016 is Drug Dealer, MD, in which you talk about how doctors were duped, patients got hooked, and why it's so hard to stop. And patients specifically talking about, you know, primarily opioids, painkilling drugs, but as well as other drugs that are prescribed by physicians. So in this approximately hour-long conversation, I would love to delve into the insights from both of these books. I finished reading Drug Dealer MD and am reading Dopamine Nation, and I'm almost done with it, but there's so much rich content and there's no way we could exhaust all of the insight in these books. So I genuinely recommend that people read these books for themselves. But this should be a good preview and summary of some of those insights. So let me just hear your voice and ask you the open-ended question. How are you in this moment?
Ah, thank you. Well, I'm doing well. I appreciate that really wonderful introduction, and also you're pointing listeners to my books, because it is hard to capture everything that's in there, you know, in a brief conversation. Right. So I appreciate that, and I'm doing fine. We had a busy clinic this morning, but things went well for the most part. So it's been a good day so far.
Mm. Well, I know that I'm coming to this conversation with the intention to come out of it better able to serve some of the populations that I work with. I know I mentioned to you that I'm a professor, but also I get to work in a jail, and most of the people that I work with in the jail have addictions. And so you are an addiction expert. And one thing I kind of take from Dopamine Nation and have come to believe based on everything that I've learned is that although people have differing levels of susceptibility to addiction, perhaps it's arguable that the human brain is quite susceptible to addiction. Especially the human brain in the context of the world we live in now, where there is pleasure to indulge in everywhere. So I want to be able to better serve the people that I work with, and I want this, and I know that this conversation will feel relevant, I think, to anyone who listens. So although the books are about different main topics, there's also connections between them. But I do want to begin by talking about Drug Dealer, MD. I'm not sure how much you looked into like this podcast and what we've talked about before. I believe you're the 50th episode, which is monumental. But we've talked about a variety of topics related to all kinds of things in psychology. And we have paid special attention to, you know, people who are critical of modern day psychiatric practices, specifically the quick diagnosis without really deeply understanding the individual. And then, of course, the quick prescription to drugs that ultimately tend to do more harm than good. So you are, you know, it's significant to me to be talking to you as someone who's interested in that topic, especially because, frankly, you are a psychiatrist. And you are a psychiatrist at a prestigious institution. And so I think, you know, your thoughts on these matters hold a lot of weight. So I'd like to maybe just read what this book is about in your own words, just right in the prologue, and then ask you a couple questions about it. So you say that the book Drug Dealer MD is your attempt to understand how well-meaning doctors across America, most of whom became doctors in the first place to save lives and alleviate suffering, ended up prescribing pills that are killing their patients, and how their patients, seeking treatment for illnesses and injury, ended up becoming ended up addicted to the very pills meant to save them. More importantly, why do we keep prescribing and consuming these dangerous drugs, even though we know better? So I can't sit here and ask you to summarize your entire book in one kind of answer to a question, but what would you say is a kind of quick answer to the question, why do we keep prescribing and consuming these dangerous drugs, even though we know better?
I think a quick answer is to look at both the human interpersonal level interactions and then look at it from a 30,000 foot view, systemic level. If we start at the human level, what we have is people who went into medicine to alleviate suffering. And we have people coming in, patient consumers, and I use that term patient consumers intentionally, who are genuinely in pain, in physical pain and psychological pain, the combination of pain. And then you add to that these pills and procedures, which in the short term very often work. They work extremely well. Opioids in the short term alleviate physical pain in most people. Benzodiazepines in the short term alleviate anxiety, insomnia in the short term in most people. Stimulants work great for almost everybody for attention, whether or not you have ADHD in the short term. And of course, a patient who expresses gratitude toward a doctor who has given them something that's actually working in the short term, that's incredibly gratifying for somebody who spent, more than a decade of their lives training to become a doctor to do just that, help other people. The problem is that these micro interactions, which are mutually reinforcing for doctors and patient consumers around the transfer of these reinforcing pills, is really at odds in many instances with patients actually getting well in a system that gratifies and reinforces short-term gains over long-term gains. Because these pills very commonly do wonders in the short term, but not only stop working in the long term as our brains adapt to them, but actually can turn on us and do actual harm, including causing the opposite of what they were meant to help, as well as causing other significant problems like addiction and overdose death. And now's where we need to back up and look at the 30,000 foot view and the fact that basically we have a healthcare system that is deeply steeped in a capitalist economy and deeply in connection with a pharmaceutical and medical device industry that is making enormous amounts of money on the backs of patients, with very little blue sky between the way that we both teach medicine and practice medicine and the bottom line goals of these industries that make medical products. And then we have a system that's really designed for short-term interventions. It's not designed to help people with chronic relapsing and remitting diseases like chronic pain, like mental illnesses, which are primarily chronic relapsing and remitting diseases, including the disease of addiction, but also other mental illnesses. And we have an aging population and more people living with chronic pain and other chronic medical illnesses. And we have a whole bunch of societal problems, which are no longer being addressed by societal institutions. They're basically being addressed as medical problems. They're being medicalized, and the medical system is essentially expected now to step in and solve not just medical problems, but also societal problems, social problems. So that means we're medicalizing things that are probably not actually medical problems. You add that all together, in the mix, and you've got, the perfect storm basically for doctors really being caught in a bind around wanting to be genuinely helpful and yet trapped in a system that doesn't reinforce and incentivize the kinds of interventions that will actually make patients better in the long run.
Excellent summary. And I can't say it gives me hope. Do you have hope?
I think I am a practical optimist, which is to say that I think humans are amazingly adaptable, which is why we've stuck around for so long, and why we seem to have done so well vis-a-vis other species. So I do think that we have a remarkable ability to analyze the problems, including the ones that we create, and adjust. So I am optimistic, but I do think it's a long, hard road, and I do think medicine is incredibly dysfunctional at this juncture in time. And I think it's going to take a long time to figure it out. One of the things that I predict will happen is that people, and this is already happening, people will in increasing numbers actually exit Western medicine. They'll become, increasingly dissatisfied and disillusioned with the kinds of treatments that traditional Western medicine provides. And they will find alternatives that will hopefully serve them better. One of the potential pitfalls here is what's sometimes referred to as the wellness industrial complex, which is now characterized by the plethora of vitamins and supplements that are being marketed and consumed by people, as an alternative to sort of FDA-approved Western remedies. And I'm not sure that's progress. I think, again, that's a potential huge moneymaker for many individuals, but not necessarily the path to wellness. So it'll be really interesting to see how we solve this problem. I'm optimistic that we will figure it out, but I think it's going to take a long time. And in the meantime, the people who are most vulnerable to the harms of the way that we practice medicine now, the poor, the disenfranchised, the unemployed, the uninsured, these are folks who unfortunately will probably bear the brunt of our dysfunctional healthcare system. Mm.
I think some people, and perhaps I'm just projecting, and this is actually what I think, I would go as far to say it's my impression that the if you look at the various branches of medicine, some are more dysfunctional than others, and it's certainly my impression that the specialty of psychiatry is particularly dysfunctional for a number of reasons. Perhaps all starting with exactly how the conditions that they treat are diagnosed in the first place, and the difficulty in verifying objectively what the etiology of a person's condition is, and then the tools that are used to treat people's conditions, and just how similar those tools are, namely stimulant drugs, benzodiazepines, antidepressants. And it's always, so yeah, this is my assessment, that psychiatry, it has to be considered the most dysfunctional. But what is your opinion about that? Do you think that's true?
I think that mental health care in general is in crisis. And I guess I would lump psychology in there as well as psychiatry. And the reason I say that is because if you look epidemiologically at the countries that have the most access to mental health care treatment, whether it's psychotropic medications or various forms of psychotherapy, what you see paradoxically is rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide increasing, not decreasing in those countries. So this correlation, not necessarily causation, but it does give one pause. We have this idea that, oh, if only mental illness weren't stigmatized, oh, if only, people had more access to mental health care treatment, we could solve so many of our societal problems. But in fact, when people do have more access to mental health care treatment, they're not necessarily getting better. And I think the reason for that is that our medications are helpful in some instances, but are certainly overprescribed, can be harmful, and don't help as much as we thought they would 30 years ago in the 1990s, which was the decade of the brain. Likewise, I think we can levy a similar criticism towards psychotherapy, which, you know, has its origins, as you know, in the early 1900s with Freud's identification of the unconscious and childhood experiences as a major driver of adult psychopathology. That has now, become cheapened by this kind of emphasis on trauma and the victim narrative, and the ways in which some psychotherapists, anyway, are catering to the desires and whims of their patients in order to keep satisfied customers, as much as any psychiatrist is doing that. Mm-hmm. So instead of pushing people toward the kinds of behavioral change that will really make a positive impact on their lives, people are circling around trauma narratives and other kinds of indulgent narratives that don't actually help people or their families or their loved ones in the long run. So I think that, acknowledging the crisis, acknowledging the need in many ways for new paradigms in mental health. I so often hear from people, the problem with addiction treatment is that we're not recognizing the co-occurring mental health disorders. And if only, these individuals could see a dual diagnosis provider, then the treatment would be so much better. I'm a dual diagnosis provider, and I can tell you, we don't have any magic wands. These are really hard problems, and they're biopsychosocial problems. So they're as much a product, I think, of the environment that we live in now, the kind of stressful, overstimulated, distracted, over-dopaminized, drugified world that we live in now, as much as they are the result of what might be going on in a given individual's brain. Certainly, there are differences in vulnerability, and I guess that's what we call mental illness, somebody who's super vulnerable to stressors in the world, but it's a really pretty stressful world. And I think we need brand new paradigms. So that's my answer. My answer to that.
Fair answer. And the victim narrative that you bring up, the paradigm that you are alluding to right now, is exactly where I wanted to go next. So it's one thing to look at the harm caused by, the overprescription of highly powerful addictive substances. That's one issue. But then there's the entire issue of the paradigm that is so pervasive in our culture that involves things, beliefs such as pain is bad and to be avoided. That, like I'm looking at my notes here, there was a few important things you pointed out about our paradigm. Like you said, pain is dangerous. The idea that psychological trauma creates a psychic wound that is the source of future suffering. That differences equate to disabilities. And the point that the paradigm and the culture shapes our narrative, and then our narrative shapes our experience. And right. So we are experiencing ourselves in light of the cultural paradigm. And of course, many of us we're swimming in the water. We don't realize we're in. And so we don't even question these beliefs that we subscribe to that define the very paradigm that informs our perception of ourselves. So I'd like to go there for a moment, and I want to read a quote that can kind of kick off this next segment of our conversation. So when we frame, quote, these differences as disabilities and disorders, you write, our culture is implicitly rejecting alternative narratives. For example, that human differences in temperament and ability are valuable and should be celebrated, and that human differences should be understood in terms of sociological, existential, and even spiritual etiologies rather than purely biological ones. So can you just speak to us about the role of these autobiographical narratives and the way that that can shape a person's own experience of themselves and of their struggles?
Sure. I mean, so after more than two decades of listening to people's stories, which is what, you know, psychiatrists and psychologists in clinical practice do, I've become convinced that the way that we tell our autobiographical narratives is not just a way to organize past events, it actually predicts our future behavior. Because the way that we tell our stories provides a kind of roadmap or signpost for decisions going forward. And that there are certain ways that people tell their stories that's healthy, and other ways, in my experience, that's not healthy. And the victim narrative, this idea that all of my problems are a result of some kind of terrible experience I've undergone in the past, generally that doesn't serve people very well. I'm the first one to say that we need a framework in order to navigate the world. That's just how the human brain works. We need some kind of map or framework or understanding of why we do what we do. And the dominant framework now, which is Freud's legacy, is that the things that happened to me before have shaped me in a certain way and are now controlling or predicting what I can and cannot do going forward. This is something that we just implicitly believe is true. And yet, I think we need to question this. Really, how true is that? How true is that my current experience of the world is primarily influenced by something that I experienced when I was 5 years old or 10 years old or 15 years old? Certainly, we are shaped by our experience, but to what extent is that experience actually creating what I'm doing in the here and now versus that what I'm doing in the here and now is predominantly controlled or influenced by my immediate environment, the things that are in my environment, the people that are in my environment, the groups that I hang out with, the where I go and what do I do in the course of the day, as opposed to these past experiences. Mm-hmm. And I really begin to question that fundamental sort of narrative that says, in particular, this bad thing makes me who I am and therefore influences is the predominant filter through which I'm now experiencing the world. Let me just give you an example again from my clinic this morning. Anonymously, obviously, no identifying information, a patient of ours who's really been stuck in her life, continuing to use cannabis and alcohol, depressed and anxious. And whenever, you know, it comes up that she probably needs to change her behaviors in order to improve her life, her mind reflexively and immediately goes to a childhood trauma that she experienced, which then she lays over like a film on her entire perception of herself in the world to explain to herself why it is she's stuck. First, I want to acknowledge that experience most likely had an impact on her and her brain and her understanding of the world and how she responds to certain triggers. But to assume that is the predominant reason for her current experience, I don't think is accurate. And furthermore, not helpful to her. Because it's sort of a reflexive way to say, again, that there's nothing that she can do about it. She's so triggered by it that she can't move forward. So I think it's really a matter of finding a balance between, yes, going over our past is important, knowing ourselves, knowing where we've been and what we've experienced, trying to understand it, putting it into words, telling another human being. I find this all very, very valuable and important. But then we need to move on and say, okay, what else is going on? You know, what other factors are at play here? And furthermore, how can I change my behavior so that I can change my internal experience? I mean, basically, we are organisms that are constantly interacting with our environment. And it's the way that we respond to the infinite number of relentless cues that we're getting that essentially makes us who we are. So we need a different filter, you know, to go over that. This kind of constantly going back to our trauma as the touchstone for understanding everything that happens to us, I just think it's not that helpful in the end.
Mm. One of the he was a psychiatrist, although I think most people would think of the work he did as the work of a psychologist. But anyway, the people I've studied the most is Viktor Frankl, mm-hmm. and his logotherapy, his form of therapy that he created, is very important for people to know about, I think, and to know that there are actually logotherapists out in the world. It's funny because sometimes I think when we think of therapy, when the common person thinks of therapy, it is almost a caricature of Freud's lying on the couch talking about your past traumas scene. And Viktor Frankl's logotherapy, which is a meaning-based therapy that is devoted to reorienting a person to the meaning in their lives. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that that's extremely powerful. It's been extremely effective for me personally and could be summarized, especially in comparison to psychoanalysis, as psychoanalysis could be said to be emphasizing the way that a person should look backward and inward. And logotherapy emphasizes the way that a person should look forward and outward.
Love it. Love it.
Beautiful.
That's great.
I love it. And mm-hmm. his, you know, Viktor Frankl's position was that we don't find, yes, our past has great meaning. Yes, we have precious memories. Yes, our story matters. But when it comes to the meaning that motivates us to keep living and to keep mm-hmm. enduring our mm-hmm. struggle, mm-hmm. we find that in the future.
Right.
We don't find that within ourselves. We find it beyond ourselves, mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. and especially in the people who need our love or the responsibilities and tasks that we are uniquely equipped to fulfill mm-hmm. outside mm-hmm. of ourselves. So I've always felt very empowered by that. And
maybe that's a wonderful orientation. And it's similar to acceptance and commitment therapy, you know, a kind of a value-based, outward looking, you know, way of basically showing up for our lives, right? Yeah, not getting lost in our own sort of ruminations, but trying to be present, try to show up for our lives, try to live in alignment with our morals and values and our sense of purpose and meaning. Yeah. Really, really important. I agree. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is similarly oriented. You know, this kind of like feelings come after behaviors.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of sort of in traditional psychotherapy, you know, for sorting out feelings and cognitions and then waiting until those are sorted to do behaviors. And AA is all about, you know what, you need to do the behaviors first, right? And the feelings and the cognitions will follow. Mm. And I find that to be really true and a really important message, especially in a world in which we've become increasingly bystanders to our own lives because of the sedentary and disembodied and virtual nature of our existence. I think this message around, you know, returning to our bodies, returning to the present moment, engaging with the real world has become one of even more urgency because of the technology and the way that, you know, we're existing in this digital space.
Mm, well said, agreed. I'll read one more passage from Drug Dealer and then ask you one more question about it. And then we'll move on to the topic of dopamine more explicitly. So toward the end of your book, there's a section entitled Doctors as Baristas. And in this passage, you wrote, the current prescription drug epidemic is not the result of a small population of deviant doctors willfully harming patients, although those doctors exist. Rather, it is the result of a large population of well-intended doctors working in healthcare factories that prioritize throughput of body parts on an assembly line over whole patient health. The result is overprescribing, which is faster and better reimbursed than educating and empathizing with patients. Pills that are addictive are particularly likely to be overprescribed because they provide patient customers with short-term satisfaction and a proxy for human attachment, but not necessarily improved health. When autonomy is truncated and professional status is linked to earning power and patient satisfaction surveys, doctors are vulnerable to objectifying patients as commodities rather than seeing them as people. Patients are vulnerable to utilizing doctors as nothing more than a source of drugs. I wanted to read that passage because I feel like it hits on many points that you really carefully elaborate upon throughout the book. And, you know, in no uncertain terms, clarifies and identifies the problem. And where I wanted to kind of go with that is, it's sometimes to people with some awareness of the nature of these substances, these drugs, sometimes it's kind of an elephant in the room that they are not as different as most people tend to think they are from illicit drugs. And when you realize that, it becomes shocking that the way that they are prescribed and to whom they are prescribed. When a child is, you know, when a child is prescribed an amphetamine, but it's just thought of as medication, that gives you a totally different emotional response than the idea that a child is like using meth. But that's not, those aren't as different as we think they are. So I guess I want to hear your reflections on this issue that we have legal drugs and illegal drugs. The legal drugs are socially sanctioned, the illegal drugs are stigmatized, and yet the chemical nature of them is not nearly as different as people think, aside from safety and regulation and purity. And to me, it's just, it seems like an extremely alarming, urgent problem that specifically psychoactive substances are being prescribed to vulnerable populations under false pretenses. So I'm just curious to hear your thoughts about this.
One of the ways that Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, was so successful in marketing and selling OxyContin beginning in the late 1990s was to convince doctors that as long as they were prescribing opioids to real patients with real pain, there was a less than 1% chance that those individuals would get addicted. In other words, there was this idea that the prescription itself conferred some kind of magic halo effect, protecting that individual from developing addiction to opioids, and that indeed there was a physiologic underpinning that somehow having pain would protect that individual from getting addicted to opioids prescribed there by their doctor. Not surprisingly, this led to, in part, was a major contributor, this kind of false marketing, to the current opioid epidemic that we face today, the fourfold increase in opioid prescribing between the late 1990s and 2012, accompanied by a fourfold increase in opioid overdose deaths, primarily prescription opioids and opioid addiction. And we see that same kind of myth playing out with other types of drugs. This idea that somehow, you know, methamphetamine prescribed to people with ADHD by a psychiatrist or other healthcare provider is wildly different from a person getting methamphetamine off the street. Same exact chemical compound. You know, papers being published by esteemed academics saying, not only will people with ADHD who get stimulants from their doctor not get addicted to those stimulants, but they'll be protected more broadly from the problem of addiction, a specious claim that is not true, not founded in science, and has now been largely debunked. Although I still often encounter psychiatrists who will say, well, I've heard that prescribing stimulants to someone with ADHD is going to make them less likely to get addicted in adult life. Oh, that's just not true. You know, these substances are as addictive when prescribed by a doctor as they are if you get them on the street. Simple access or exposure to any drug is one of the most important risk factors for getting addicted to that drug. Whether that drug is an opioid you get from your doctor for pain, a stimulant you get from your psychiatrist for ADHD, a benzo you get from your primary care doctor for anxiety or insomnia. The rates of addiction in patient populations, for example, with chronic pain, who got addicted to opioids through a prescription from their doctor, is about 1 in 4 patients, not the less than 1% that Purdue claims. So about a quarter of patients who get an opioid from their doctor will develop an opioid use problem.
Gosh.
I'd like to also just highlight, we're now seeing the same kind of mythology emerging with psychedelics. This idea that somehow, you know, if you get your psychedelic from a specially trained mental health care provider in the context of psychotherapy, you know, it's not dangerous. You know, it doesn't involve many of these other dangers. Well, I'll believe it when I see it. You know what I mean? I mean, psychedelics, contrary to what you'll read in the popular press, they are addictive. They can be habit forming. They can cause other forms of neurological damage, persistent illusions and hallucinations that last for a person's whole life, psychotic breakdowns, you know, mood instability. So these are dangerous drugs, potentially dangerous drugs. They may have some clinical utility, but we don't yet have the evidence to support that. And I would be very wary of the trope that as long as they're being prescribed by a doctor in some kind of rarefied setting, that they're you know, going to be less harmful.
So I have some questions about dopamine that I think I really want to ask you. And I think I teach a biological psychology class, and I think I'll be better at teaching about this topic thanks to this book and to our conversation. So I'd like to start by saying, I think most people know that dopamine is associated with pleasure, that it's associated with reward, but it's gotten to the point where it also seems like it's somewhat oversimplified in that anything that feels good at all is considered to be a result of it releasing dopamine in the brain. And maybe there's some level of truth to that, but I can't help but think about the incredible diversity of good, pleasant, positive experiences and the differences in the emotional quality of those experiences that we would lump together in the category of like desirable, good experiences. So everything from, you know, trying drugs to I know you talk about like the simple pleasures and how that is different, that it doesn't tip the scale in the same way, but even like trying drugs, having sex with someone you love, and then eating a good meal. And then like, I have a baby at home and she lights my brain up with all the best chemicals and the joy is so intense, but it's so qualitatively different than other types of pleasurable experiences, like when I win in my fantasy football league and stuff like that, you know? And so it seems like there's this broad oversimplification of the role of dopamine in our brains because it's attributed to literally everything that feels good in any possible way. So my first question, I don't expect you to be able to just answer it off the top of your head, but how much do we know about the profile of neurotransmitters that are released with all the various types of positive experiences? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is a very exciting time in neuroscience where there's an explosion of research in this area. We're at the very dawn of understanding how this works in the brain. Dopamine was discovered as a human neurotransmitter only in the 1950s, so not even that long ago. And since then, there's been just a plethora of exciting work around dopamine and how it relates to pleasure, reward, and motivation, maybe even more important for motivation and the work that we're willing to do to get our reward than the experience of pleasure itself. Obviously, it's an oversimplification, and I use this metaphor in my book, Dopamine Nation, of the pleasure-pain balance. Again, an oversimplification. Different reinforcers work through different primary mechanisms. But dopamine is probably a final common pathway for all reinforcing substances and behaviors, including the joy that you get from your child. You know, that probably does involve dopamine, along with a whole suite of other hormones and neurotransmitters like oxytocin, the love hormone, serotonin, which is usually like our attachment and, you know, sort of oneness feeling hormone or neurotransmitter. So, you know, we're just at the dawn of understanding. But dopamine has just sort of become kind of like a common currency for measuring how reinforcing these substances and behaviors are, primarily in animal models, as well as human brain imaging studies. So it's become a way to kind of look at that. But clearly, it is not the only molecule. At the end of the day, 100 years from now, we may determine that it was in fact a minor actor, and that there was something, you know, very different going on. Yeah. One of the exciting areas in brain research now, emerging now, is that what we're really dealing with is circuits in the brain. Like we've identified a reward circuit in the brain. This is not just one area, but a constellation of areas that fire in unison in response to certain types of events or in relation to certain types of emotions or behaviors or cognitions. So getting away from this idea of, oh, you know, addiction's located in this part of the brain and depression's located in that part of the brain, instead looking at these circuits and how they interact with each other. So, you know, that's my answer. It's okay. Where there's a lot yet to learn. But yeah. I would say that, you know, love addiction is real. Mm-hmm. And you may not experience that or be vulnerable to that. And of course, you know, the meaning and purpose that we feel in relation to pleasure and pain can vastly modify that experience. So one of my favorite studies is a study of soldiers in World War II. An anesthesiologist, Beecher, looked at their pain levels in response to very serious injuries on the battlefield. We're talking like amputated limbs, guts spilling out. And what he found was remarkable, which was that 2/3 of those soldiers in the immediate aftermath of their injuries felt zero pain. And the way that he put that together after interviewing the soldiers was to realize that the meaning of the pain for those soldiers was such that they literally didn't feel pain. What was the meaning? Well, number one, I'm alive. And number two, I'm probably getting out of here, right? And those were very good things. And in that context, the physical pain, literally, they didn't feel it. As a wonderful inverse of that, there's a very famous British case report of a construction worker who jumps on a huge nail that goes right through his boot and right through his foot. He looks down at the nail protruding through the middle of his foot, starts screaming. He feels agonizing pain. They take him to the emergency room. They load him up on opioids. Finally, you know, he passes out. He gets so many opioids. They carefully pull out the very large nail, gently remove his boot, and discover that the nail went right between his toes. So in other words, zero tissue injury. And yet when his brain looked down at his foot, he felt injury. He felt real pain that wasn't made up. So again, you know, how we contextualize and create meaning around these sensory experiences has a huge impact on our behaviors, how we actually experience the stimulus, and how and when and why we might do it again.
Fascinating. I feel like one of the key points that you elucidated in your book is the connection between pleasure and pain. So I have like another question that I just wouldn't be able to answer for myself if someone asked me. So I want to ask you. We all know, like, okay, so let's say I'll share from personal experience. About a year ago, I applied for a full-time position and went through to the final interviews. And then, long story short, got a call that I was not selected for the position. And so when I received the call, I feel like my brain was like ready to go one way or another, pleasure or pain. and it was pain, right? But then a few months ago, you know, thankfully I had another opportunity for another place and I got the full-time position, which I had been seeking, you know, for a long time. And so when I got that phone call, I remember it vividly and I answered it. And again, my brain was like ready to go one direction or another and it went full pleasure, excitement. Nice. So my question is, it seems like, okay, I can wrap my mind around what happened in my brain when I got the good news and all the reward circuits started firing off, dopamine started circulating. But what happened in my brain when I got the bad news? Is there some type of, is it just the absence of the dopamine release, or is there some other neurological explanation for that?
Yeah, great. I don't know the answer to that question. It's a great question. The metaphor that I use is really in relation, pain in relation to the pleasure and the way that our brain re-equilibrates after pleasure is by, you know, tipping to the pain side. But that's a great question. I don't know the answer.
Well, let's go to what you are just talking about. You say in the book, you know, pain and pleasure are co-located in the brain. And they so tell us, what is the relationship between pain and pleasure in the brain?
Yeah. So pain and pleasure work like opposite sides of a balance. So if you imagine a beam on a central fulcrum, like a teeter-totter in a kid's playground, when the balance tips one way, we experience pleasure. And when it tips pain, the other way we experience pain. And there are several rules that govern that balance. And the most important of those rules is that the balance wants to remain level. And that with any deviation from neutrality, or what neuroscientists call homeostasis, our brains will work very hard to get back to that level position. And the way that our brains do that is first by tilting an equal and opposite amount to the side of, to whatever the opposite of the stimulus was. So let's say we ingest an intoxicant, chocolate, cannabis, alcohol, pornography, Netflix binge, releases dopamine in our reward pathway. The balance tilts to the side of pleasure. But no sooner has that happened than our brain adapts by tilting not just to the neutral position, but to the painful side. I like to imagine that as these neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again, but they like it there. So they stay on until it's tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the come down, the hangover, the after effect, or that moment of wanting one more piece of chocolate, one more Netflix video, one more drink. Now, if we wait long enough, the gremlins hop off and it goes back to the level position. But the key there is that in our brains, the way that we restore homeostasis is by first experiencing pain after any pleasure. And that's important to recognize because it tells us that with any pleasure, we pay a price. It's not for free. The way that we get back to that level position, that drive toward homeostasis, is accomplished through that little oppositional phase, which is actually a dopamine deficit state. So what's happening in our brains in response to the brief increase in dopamine is that we adapt to that by downregulating our dopamine receptors and dopamine production. Now, with minor intoxicants, the pleasure-pain balance is supple. It easily does that and adjusts and go back to the level position. We may not even be aware of experiencing a come down. But with intoxicants or things that release a lot of dopamine all at once, we don't just get a little tip to the side of pain to compensate. We get a great big tip. There's really a noticeable come down from that before our balance goes to the level position. And then here's the key thing to understanding addiction, which is the second rule of the balance. With repeated pleasures, the same or similar stimulus, that initial deviation to pleasure gets weaker and shorter, but that after response to pain gets stronger and longer, which is, you know, really unfortunate for us, right? But what happens is those gremlins start to accumulate. We get more and more, and pretty soon we've got enough gremlins to fill this whole room, camped out on the pain side of the balance, tents and barbecues in tow. Mm-hmm. And now we've entered addicted brain. Now we're walking around with a brain that's essentially chronically tilted to the side of pain. We've changed our threshold for experiencing pleasure. Now we need a whole lot more pleasure in more potent forms to not just feel pleasure, but actually go back to the neutral position and feel normal when we're not using, we're walking around with a balance tilted to the side of pain, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving. And other more modest pleasures are no longer reinforcing, because when we put those on the pleasure side of our balance, they do nothing in you know, to level out all the gremlins camped out on the pain side. So, you know, one hypothesis for your experience with the good news, you know, or the bad news that you got initially, is that it did, in fact, you know, tilt your balance to the side of pain. Maybe, you know, maybe it was mediated through dopamine and other feel-good neurotransmitters like serotonin, norepinephrine. You know, maybe you went into that compensatory state. And then when that happens, actually, when we intentionally tilt on the pain side, something called hormesis, we actually will start to upregulate our own endogenous production of dopamine. So, for example, that's why exercise, we feel good after it, the runner's high, or ice cold water baths are helpful for increasing dopamine levels and serotonin levels, because the gremlins hop on the pleasure side to try to bring it level again. But bad things that happen to us that we don't do intentionally, like bad news that you got you, it's harder to know. I don't know. You know, I don't know what's happening in that instance. I don't think we have much science on that.
Very interesting. So I know that so many people, I think, have had the experience where they seeking pleasure becomes increasingly futile because things don't feel pleasurable anymore, and they experience this anhedonia, and the things that once brought them happiness don't anymore. And so you talk about, you know, kind of a remedy for that as being kind of dopamine fasting. Can you talk to us about what dopamine fasting is and what effects it could have?
Yeah. So basically I ask my patients, or, you know, you can do this experiment on yourself, to identify that substance or that behavior that's problematic in your life. The four C's: control, compulsions, cravings, and consequences, which is a way we summarize the DSM criteria for addiction. And go ahead and eliminate that substance, assuming you're not going to have a life-threatening withdrawal, like from alcohol or benzos. Eliminate that substance from your life for 30 days. Why 30 days? Because 30 days is usually the average amount of time it takes for those neuroadaptation gremlins to hop off the pain side of the balance and for homeostasis or a level balance to be restored. I find this to be a really useful exercise to recapture the pleasure that we get from that substance or behavior, but more importantly, to actually reset our threshold overall so that we're not walking around in a sub-threshold state of withdrawal, so that we can take pleasure in more modest rewards, and so that we can look at our consumptive behaviors and more objectively identify the true impact of that consumption on our lives. Because when we're chasing dopamine, we don't see true cause and effect, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll have patients come in depressed, and they'll say, can you give me a pill or some psychotherapy for the depression? And they'll be smoking cannabis every day. And I'll say, well, you know, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to ask you to do is to stop the cannabis for a month, because my hypothesis is that just stopping the cannabis is going to reset your reward pathways, and you're going to be less depressed and less anxious just by doing that alone. Mm. And I base that on many, many years of clinical experience and seeing that it's true. But patients are very resistant to this idea. They say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Because when I smoke, that makes me feel better. So how could it be that stopping smoking is going to make me feel better? I said, well, in the moment, yes, it makes you feel better because you're medicating withdrawal from your last dose and temporarily counteracting the gremlins on the pain side of the balance. But in the long run, what you're doing with smoking is actually accumulating more gremlins on the pain side of the balance. Mm-hmm. So by stopping, you're letting those gremlins hop off. You're restoring homeostasis. And, you know, about 80% of patients will come in a month later and they're shocked at how much they feel better, how much better they feel, how much less depressed, how much less anxious, how they're sleeping better. And, you know, and just the surprise there is so telling, because it really speaks to the way we cannot really see true cause and effect with our own behaviors until we press a lever, do the experiment, change our experience, and see the outcome. Right. Which is this whole idea where behaviors have to come first and emotions will follow. You can't wait till you feel like stopping. Stop and see what happens, and then reevaluate.
You know, I think It's interesting to think about, like, the problem is overconsumption. And then, of course, there are probably some substances where any amount of consumption is probably problematic. But for the most part, it seems to me that the problem is overconsumption of the things that cause dopamine release. And I feel like the unexamined assumption that most people have subscribed to when they carry out those behaviors of overconsumption is the assumption that if a little bit is good, more must be better. If a little bit is good, more must be better. Right. So two shots of a tequila get me social and on the dance floor, then four shots must make me double the social and right. double the good dancer. And to me, I just think this must be exposed in our own minds, this false belief, because of course, like whether it's social media or cannabis or alcohol or sex or anything that is pleasurable, we want, I know your message is not avoid all of that forever. Of course, it's don't overconsume it. And right. I think the overconsumption, like one of the little just psychological beliefs there is, yeah, well, clearly a little bit is good. So more must multiply how good it is. But often that's quite the opposite. More just makes it worse.
Right. I agree with you. And I think the other key piece for people to realize is that anything that releases a lot of dopamine, you know, all at once in the reward pathway will be followed by a come down. Mm. And when we are in that come down state, we are in craving. Mm. And we are evolutionarily designed over millions of years of evolution to consume anything that releases dopamine as much as we can, whenever we can, because we evolved for a world of scarcity. The problem is we're no longer living in that world. Now, when we experience that come down, there's plenty more of our drug at the touch of our fingertips. Mm-hmm. And so that cycle, that loop that drives the compulsive overconsumption, the reason it's so hard to stay at, you know, a modest amount, is built into our hardwiring. And we need to really appreciate that and understand that, which is why, you know, we need to be really vigilant about putting what I call self-binding strategies in place to help us limit our consumption. We can't wait till we're in that state of craving, because in that state of craving, all of us would reach for, you know, the second piece of chocolate, or not reach to stop the next Netflix episode, right? So on Netflix, you actually have to do an action to not get the next. And that's the world we live in now, right? The next episode is coming, with you just sitting there passively. That is the world we live in now.
Yes. Well, I'm aware of the time and of your time, and I know you have to go. So thank you so much for joining me. I know that everyone listening, I'm sure, enjoyed it as much as I did. I'll continue to follow your work and read the next books that you write and listen to all the podcasts that you're doing. I know you're on a bit of a tour right now. And it's amazing. You know, I think this is really going to help people. So thank you so much for the work that you do and for spending time with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I've enjoyed our conversation. You have a very nice, calm, and soothing voice, and you speak at a very calm and soothing pace in contrast to the way that I speak. So I really enjoyed that and appreciated it.
Well, good. I'm glad. Well, I trust we'll stay connected.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.